welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 14th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. We'll start looking at the weather over the next few days. Today, it's going to be mostly cloudy with wind southeast 10 to 20 miles an hour, a high of 37 and a low of 25. You may have heard in other media sources we're expecting snow tonight, so snow is likely overnight and into tomorrow, with winds 5 to 10, a high tomorrow of 37, a low of 23. And then on Wednesday, and still continuing that chance of snow, winds 10 to 20 with a high of 33, a low of 17. Today's weather story comes to us from meteorologist Corey Thompson, and it says snow risk would beat the average. Our eyes are on a chance for snow early this week, with an extended period from Monday night through Wednesday, bringing a shot at our first accumulating snowfall. At least an inch seems highly likely. This would actually beat the long-term averages for the first measurable inch of snowfall for Cedar Rapids. That falls on about December 6th. Again, it's an average, so the spread between dates when it actually occurs can vary widely. The earliest ever for at least an inch of snow was October 18, 1972, though we've had other late October snows recently, too. The latest ever was February 11, 1944, which is the only year when snow of that depth held off for that long. I will tell you that I have seen some updated forecasts saying that the snow anticipated is now between 2 and 4 inches. Let's move to the Gazette's front page. They have several stories, local stories, one of which is by Vanessa Miller, titled UI Seeks to Pause Paying Hospital Jury Award. Dateline, Iowa City. Instead of paying a Cedar Rapids contractor the $12.8 million a jury awarded last month, the University of Iowa is asking a judge to pause a requirement it pay the money so it can dispute the verdict or appeal in a dispute over construction of its costly Stead Family Children's Hospital. In a motion filed by the Iowa Attorney General's Office on behalf of the State UI and State Board of Regents, it claimed defendants respectfully request the court to order a stay of enforcement and/or execution of judgment or any further proceedings in this matter until the parties have had the opportunity to fully brief their post-trial motions and the court issues its rulings. Any, quote, post-trial motions the state has filed or plans to file haven't yet been made public, but its November 7th request to pause payment of the recent judgment indicated the UI and the board want a judge to vacate the verdict or grant a new trial. Rules the state cited for its planned post-trial motions are ones allowing defendants who lose at trial to argue for a new trial if, for example, they were harmed by irregular proceedings, jury misconduct, an accident or surprise, errors of law, newly discovered evidence, or excessive or inadequate damages appearing to have been influenced by passion or prejudice. Defendants assert that thorough consideration of their post-trial motions is sufficient cause to issue a stay in this case, the state argued, hinting at an appeal of the verdict, and additionally saying, in addition, a stay does not waive the right to appeal. The motion says the contractor won't be harmed by a delay of payment, as post-judgment interest will accrue while these proceedings are litigated. Contractor Modern Piping, on October 27th, the day after its favorable verdict, asked the court to require the state, UI, and Regents to pay an additional $16 million related to issues about posting a bond and questions that arose at the start of the disagreement in 2016. The state responded by arguing, among other things, that the bond issues related to the dispute were resolved years ago, and it urged the court to reject the contractor's ask for a bond payment amounting to 125% of the $12.8 million jury award. The state of Iowa continues to be an entity that will remain in existence and has the ability to pay damages once post-trial matters are resolved, according to the Attorney General's office. The October verdict, which came after jurors deliberated just over an hour, found the UI in April 2016 wrongfully blocked the American Arbitration Association from mediating its disputes with Modern Piping on both its 14-story Stead Family Children's Hospital and Hancher Auditorium projects. The $12.8 million decision, if the university ends up paying it, would bring expenses tied to the hospital, originally budgeted at $270.8 million, to more than $400 million. In addition to legal costs and contractor disputes, project expenses escalated following delays and mismanagement, as cataloged in the Gazette's, quote, Tower of Troubles investigation in 2018. A judge first sided with Modern Piping and the Arbitration Association in 2017, ordering the UI to pay tens of millions. The university's request for a new trial was denied, compelling a UI appeal, which the Court of Appeals also rejected, upholding the ruling against the UI and affirming a Johnson County District Court judge's $21.5 million award for Modern Piping. Modern Piping then filed a claim seeking compensation for costs it incurred from the university's original refusal to arbitrate, resulting in the recent verdict. Separate from its Modern Piping dispute, the university in June sued two contractors responsible for installing defective, delaminating, and cracking windows in its children's hospital. Work to assess the damage, install temporary fixes, and restore the windows is expected to cost $10 to $15 million. If the university doesn't receive any compensation for those costs and it pays the recent jury award, expenses tied to the Children's Hospital could top $420.5 million. Should a judge award the additional $16 million bond payment, the tally would swell to $436.5 million, a 61% increase over its original budget. And from Grace King, we have this article titled Apprenticeships Plant the Seed for Future Teachers. Dateline Marion. Lynmar High School senior Kyra Kanz is an apprentice in a kindergarten classroom, earning her paraeducator certificate and exploring her interest in becoming a teacher. Kanz, age 17, said she wanted to get first-hand experience in a classroom before committing to an education major in college. Only a few days into her apprenticeship, she was teaching five-year-olds about food groups like protein, grains, dairy, vegetables, and fruits. She said it's an amazing opportunity to be a mini teacher and get experience inside the classroom. I needed proof this is a good path for me to go down. Kanz is one of 12 students working as classroom apprentices, thanks to a one-time state grant using federal American Rescue Plan Act funds. The Iowa Department of Education and Iowa Workforce Development Agency allocated $9 million for the program, which also helps paraeducators become certified teachers. Kanz spends 10 hours a week at Westfield Elementary in Robbins in the classroom of Tara Dirks, who was Kanz's kindergarten teacher. As an apprentice, she's paid $12 an hour, which helps her save for college. Lynmar Associate Superintendent Nathan Weir said the apprentices help in classrooms and with recess, and also help get students on and off buses. Students applied for the apprenticeships, were interviewed, and had background checks before being accepted into the program. Weir said the main qualification he was looking for was interest. We want it to be as inclusive as possible, he said. School districts are required to provide education and training to the apprentices by partnering with community colleges or four-year colleges and universities. The apprentices at Lynmar are earning their paraeducator certificates through Kirkwood Community College. Lynmar also is using some of the grant money to train more than 20 of the district's current paraeducators as teachers, with Mount Mercy University offering in-person classes on the Lynmar campus. Weir said in 2 years, we'll have an additional 20 certified teachers who hopefully will stay with us here at Lynmar. It's one of the best programs we've seen have an impact on our employees to address the workforce shortage. The program provides up to $17,000 a year for 2 years to cover paraeducators' tuition and fees at a public or private four-year college or university. Other area school districts using the two-year grants to train paraeducators as teachers include Marion Independent, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Mount Vernon, Anamosa, Centerpoint Urbana, Albernett, Iowa Valley, English Valleys, Tipton, Benton, Monticello, and Mid Prairie. Lynmar High School senior Emily Brenham, age 17, is an apprentice at Wilkins Elementary in a fourth grade class. Brenham, who's planning to become a teacher, said, I'm very appreciative that I can start learning now. Ryan Phillips, the school facilitator at Novak Elementary in Marion, said the two student apprentices there are gaining experience in a classroom they might not otherwise get until their third or fourth years of college. He hopes it fosters their interest in teaching, saying, "We won't see dividends from a program like this for 4 or 5 years. All we can do is plant the seed. They're a blessing to the building by providing extra support and being peer role models," he said, concluding, "I know our little people love having them over here." Moving to Iowa Today, Isabella Zaluska provides this article titled "Iowa City Council to Discuss Filling Newly Vacant Seat." The Iowa City Council is scheduled to discuss Tuesday how to move forward with filling a vacancy after Councilmember Janice Weiner was elected to represent Iowa Senate District 45. The council can fill the vacancy for the remainder of the term, either by appointment or holding a special election. There is about 1 year left on Weiner's 4-year term. Weiner's resignation becomes effective January 1st, and the at-large term runs through January 2nd, 2024. If the city council decides to fill the vacancy by appointment, voters still could petition to hold a special election instead. An election would cost at least $50,000, city staff said. Council members could make a decision Tuesday or vote to defer it to a later meeting. Weiner, a Democrat, easily won the Senate seat with more than 80% of the vote over Republican Howard Weilbrenner. District 45 includes much of Iowa City and all of University Heights. The Coralville City Council earlier this year filled a vacancy by appointment. After weighing the two options, the council ultimately agreed on appointment because it was less costly and would fill the vacancy faster. The North Liberty City Council, however, had a special election earlier this year to fill a vacancy. The estimated cost of the election was $5,000. A memo to the Iowa City Council from city staff outlines the two options. The memo said if the majority of council is in favor of a special election, the election should be held as soon as practical, end quote. If the city notifies the Johnson County Auditor's Office by Wednesday, the election would be held as soon as February 7th with a primary on January 10th. The council could have the election sooner, on January 31st, with a primary on January 3rd, but the memo brought up the proximity to the holiday season. The cost estimate for both a primary and special election is about $100,000, the memo said. If only a regular election is needed, the cost will be $50,000. At the time of council's decision, it will not be known if a primary will be needed. The Iowa League of Cities told the city that the, quote, "vast majority of cities choose to appoint because it is faster and cheaper," end quote, according to the memo. If council decides to make an appointment, it must be made within 60 days after the vacancy occurs. The council would have between January 1st and March 1st to make the appointment. It will be up to the council to craft its application for people to apply and decide how to proceed, such as conducting public interviews. Residents have two opportunities to file a petition for a special election. Residents can file a petition within 14 days after the council decides on appointment and within 14 days after the appointment is made. A petition requesting a special election must have signatures from at least 743 eligible Iowa City voters. If council needs more time, the decision can be deferred, but this would push back the election dates, the memo said. Before I move on, I do want to mention a correction that's posted here in the Iowa Today section, and it may impact some of you, I don't know, but it's under the heading of wrong date. Cherish the Ladies, an all-female ensemble, performs Celtic music at 7:30 p.m. today at the Paramount Theater, 123 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Cost ranges from $5 to $30. The date of the performance was incorrect in a Things to Do This Week listing that occurred yesterday. So again, Cherish the Ladies, an all-female ensemble, will perform Celtic music at 7:30 p.m. today at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. Under the government notes section is this article, First Iowa City Tourism Grants Awarded. Think Iowa City awarded the first two grants earlier this month as part of the Iowa City Tourism Grant Program. The Refocus Film Festival and the Iowa Golden Gloves State Championships are two events that received funding. The tourism grant program launched in September. The program, funded by pandemic relief dollars from the city of Iowa City, is intended to spur economic activity in the city. Nick Pfeiffer, Vice President of Public Affairs at Think Iowa City, said these are two vastly different events, but both will bring unique audiences to Iowa City. The Refocus Film Festival, which received a $15,000 grant, is organized by Film Scene and will take place over 4 days in fall 2023 with films, performances, and art installations. I-Core Boxing, which received a grant of $7,500, will host the 2023 Iowa Golden Gloves State Championships the first weekend of April in the Graduate Hotel in downtown Iowa City. According to Think Iowa City, this is a unique event never before seen here. The Iowa City Council approved the funding for the grant program this past summer. Up to $30,000 is available for new events, and up to $5,000 is available for existing events or initiatives. The funds are available through 2026 or until exhausted. Applications are reviewed monthly. Moving to the next government note, new mental health liaison in Johnson County. Community Crisis Services has hired a law enforcement liaison to help Coralville, North Liberty, and Johnson County. Kiana Pope will be stationed in North Liberty and work with the North Liberty Police Department, Coralville Police Department, and Johnson County Sheriff's Office. Pope will work directly with law enforcement agencies to respond to and follow up on mental health crises that officers encounter. The partnership will focus on increasing division, as well as increasing access to mental health resources and other treatment services. City Council members in Coralville and North Liberty approved the agreement in August. In 2021, community hired a mental health liaison who works with the Iowa City Police Department. Next, Cedar Rapids proceeds with Check Village Pump Station. The Cedar Rapids City Council last week accepted bids from Amana-based WRH Inc. for the 12th Avenue Southwest Pump Station, coming in over $25.8 million. The pump station is designed to pump rainfall runoff from Check Village over a levee and into a river. It will be the city's largest pump station once complete, with four 36,353-gallon per minute pumps. This pump station will be supported by a detention basin. The basin stores stormwater peak flows, which allowed the pump station to be smaller and less costly to build and maintain long term. Construction work is slated to begin this winter and be complete by October 31, 2024. Rob Davis, the City Flood Control Program Manager, said the construction timeline was extended because during the bidding period because of supply chain issues. This design option also necessitated the construction of a relocated Riverside Park and Skate Park, which will be rebuilt closer to C Street Southwest. Council member Ann Poe said, "It's taken us a while to get here. I'm really excited to see this be developed." For the skate park relocation project, the council awarded Albernette-based Perk Tobin Construction, Inc. the contract for about $1.6 million. Among the other bidders for the project was California-based Spone Ranch, which the city used to help design the reconfigured skate park. Construction on the skate park is anticipated to start in the spring and wrap up by October 31, 2023. Next, Gardner Golf Course in Cedar Rapids is closed for the season at the end of play November 10th because of predicted cold temperatures. According to a news release, Ellis and Twin Pines will stay open as long as weather permits. And here we go with another one. Cedar Rapids okays rezoning for Linn County Overflow Shelter. The Cedar Rapids City Council approved its second and final readings to rezone land for Linn County's overflow shelter to serve the homeless population this winter. The county purchased the 16,000-square-foot building located at 1017 12th Avenue Southwest from Alliant Energy last year for $395,000 using COVID-19 funds from the American Rescue Plan Act. Council member Scott Olson, a real estate broker, worked with the county to identify the facility. He recused himself from voting on the rezoning. The county plans to close the shelter at the Fillmore Center at 520 11th Street Northwest and open the new one on 12th to serve individuals experiencing homelessness. The county and city will split the $55,000 operational cost of the shelter during its typical season. The facility would serve approximately 90 people on a given night. Willis-Dady Homeless Services will be the main staffing agency for the overflow shelter, managing night-to-night operations and supervising the building's staff. Linn County Supervisor Ben Rogers said the target opening date for the shelter is November 15th, but could be earlier depending on the weather. Rogers said 107 on-the-street homeless people were counted during July. That number is double what it was in 2019. Continuing with these government notes, new activities complex underway for Mount Vernon Schools. The Mount Vernon Community School District broke ground on a new activities complex to be built next to the high school, 731 Palisades Road, last month. The activities complex is an up to $5.7 million project, financed with a combination of $2.5 million in donations and school district funds and loans. The school board unanimously approved the construction October 12th, and dirt started moving October 24th, according to a district newsletter. The new activities complex will include a regulation-size football field, regulation soccer fields, 8-lane track, concession stand, press box, ticket booth, and seating for 1,500 people. Construction is expected to be completed by summer 2024. The activities complex will allow the district to host track meets, marching band competitions, and other activities, and give physical education classes an outdoor option. Next, Clear Creek Amana works on inclusion. The Clear Creek Amana Community School District is continuing to invest in diversity, equity, inclusion, and culture after hiring Director Angelica Brothers to lead these efforts last year. An educational equity committee met earlier this month to discuss ways the district can show an appreciation for diversity and respect for others. For example, at Clear Creek Amana High School, English language learner students showcased their home countries for all staff and students, according to meeting minutes from November 7th. The committee also reviewed results from its Conditions for Learning survey, required by the Iowa Department of Education, as a part of the plan under new federal education law, Every Student Succeeds Act. The Condition for Learning surveys seek to improve safety, student engagement, and the overall learning environment. All public schools in Iowa use the survey to assess grades 3 through 12. While elementary students overwhelmingly had a positive perception of their school, suggestions were made to provide more tangible positive feedback for students in middle and high school. And as a reminder, Government Notes is published Mondays and contains updates from area government bodies, Marissa Payne, Gage Miskimen, Isabella Zaluska, and Grace King of the Gazette contributed to this report. Next, this article from Caleb McCullough out of the Gazette's lead Des Moines Bureau. And the dateline is Des Moines. It says, independent voters still drive elections in Iowa. Republicans dominated elections across Iowa this election day, sweeping in a statewide red wave and bucking the trend seen in other states where the GOP fell short of expectations. Iowa Republicans ousted two long-serving Democratic incumbents at the state level, flipping the state treasurer and attorney general seats to Republican. By the unofficial vote tally, Democratic State Auditor Rob Sand leads his race by a narrow margin, but his Republican challenger, Todd Halber, said he will request a recount. In Iowa's four U.S. House races, the three incumbent Republicans increased their margin of victory from 2020, and Republican Zach Nunn defeated incumbent Democrat Cindy Axne in the 3rd Congressional District by less than a percentage point, and Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley defeated Democratic challenger Mike Franken. Republicans are also on track to increase their margin in both chambers of the legislature and pick up two seats in the Iowa Senate for a 34-16 majority, meaning they can prevent Democrats from blocking gubernatorial appointees. Do last Tuesday's results mean Iowa, long considered a swing state but trending Republican over the last decade, can now be called a red state? Politicians and analysts were split on the answer. Iowa State University political science professor David Peterson said the changing demographics of Republicans' voting coalition have helped solidify the party's success in the state, saying, "This is a Republican state. There is zero doubt about that." The movement to the right can be explained in part by the shifting alignment of the parties and which demographic groups are likely to support Republicans, Peterson said. Since 2016, white voters without a college degree have been coalescing around the Republican Party. About 85% of Iowans are non-Hispanic white and 71% have no bachelor's degree, according to census data. According to the AP VoteCast survey for 2022, non-college-educated white voters supported Republicans by a 2-to-1 margin nationally. Peterson said in the Obama coalition in 2008 and 2012, that was not the pattern of voting, but by 2016 and since then, that's really become the pattern of voting. But by some measures, Iowa looks more evenly split compared with more entrenched red states. Democrats make up 31.8% of registered voters in the state, based on pre-election data from the Iowa Secretary of State's office. Republicans make up 36.6%, and no party or third-party voters make up 31.5%. The margin is close enough that no party voters tend to make the difference in statewide elections, said Tim Hagel, a professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Hagel said he still considers Iowa a purple state. No party voters tend to favor incumbents and care more about kitchen table and economic issues, Hagel said. This year, the incumbent advantage was not enough to save two long-serving statewide Democrats, as independents appeared to lean toward Republicans who hammered on high inflation. He said they want to know, what are you doing? Are you doing a good job? If you've got an alternative, are things going to look better if we vote you in? According to the Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll before the election, both Kim Reynolds and U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley led their Democratic opponents among independents. Grassley had 47% of independent support, while Reynolds had 48%. In an appearance on Iowa PBS's Iowa Press last week, J. Ann Seltzer, whose firm conducts the Iowa poll, said late-deciding independents appeared to be persuaded by Republican pitches. She said, "I think part of this happened because Republicans kind of decided to be Republicans, and they persuaded some independents to come along with them." Reynolds, who was running far ahead of statewide Republicans challenging incumbent Democrats, also likely helped pull down-ballot Republicans to victory. Reynolds campaigned heavily alongside Republican Attorney General-elect Brenna Byrd, who surpassed 10-term incumbent Democrat Tom Miller by less than 2 percentage points. "I think Kim Reynolds focusing on that race made a big difference, right? ISU's," Peterson said. "If Rob Sands ends up squeaking this out, he obviously has built a brand, but I think he was helped by Reynolds focusing more on AG than on auditor." Leadership in both parties say they think Republican gains don't solidify Iowa as a red state, and independent voters and organizing could still affect future elections. Sean Bagnoski, chair of the Polk County Democrats, said there are enough voters to elect Democrats in the state, but the party has been failing in turning out the vote in recent years. He said some Democrats have relied too heavily on fundraising and TV advertising than on-ground organizing. Even in Democratic strongholds like Johnson and Polk County, Democratic candidate for Governor Deidre Jaggier's margin of victory in those counties was about 10 percentage points less than the 2018 Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubbell. "We've now gone through several cycles where Democrats raised more money, were on TV more, and were consistently losing," Bagnoski said, "and I think until we get back to grassroots organizing, we're going to keep losing." Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman said he doesn't think Iowa can be considered a permanently red state in the same camp as states like Mississippi and Kentucky, saying, "Iowa has had a very strong independent streak, a very strong populist streak for over a century. I don't think that's changed. It's a high note. I'm going to do everything in my power to keep it, but I think I would be irresponsible if I began to think that we were anything close to Tennessee or Kentucky." Despite the dire results Tuesday night, Democrats remain committed to continuing to advocate for their priorities and rebuild the party. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Ross Wilburn said in a statement he thinks Iowa remains a purple state and Democrats are laying the groundwork to come back in the future. While we don't have a Gazette editorial today, we do have several community letters, starting with this one from Mike Mashman of What Cheer, under a title Morality Police in Iowa. The morality police are terrorizing the people of Iran. I never have been to Iran, yet I've seen these morality enforcers. We don't have morality police in Iowa streets. We have the mental health police. These mental health police judge, then stalk the poor with bullets and needles. If I had money, I may be better off with the Iranians and Ayatollah, says Mike Mashman of What Cheer. Daniel McGrail of Cedar Rapids writes under the title, Pursue Local Talent for Cedar Rapids Superintendent Job. Why does the Cedar Rapids School District spend thousands of dollars recruiting a new superintendent from distant lands rather than promoting from within? I find it hard to believe that none of the local school principals would be good candidates for the position. They would start out with the advantage of having had a rigorous on-the-job training in administration at the local level. They would also be well acquainted with not only the Cedar Rapids community, but also school procedures and organization. If there are no good local candidates, that reflects poorly on the school district for not developing local talent. Do we really want an administrator who hasn't actually interacted with students for years and is fleeing a failing school system elsewhere? Says Daniel McGrail of Cedar Rapids. And then finally, we have this letter coming to us from Kate Baldwin of Norwalk, and it is a little bit longer letter entitled, Vouchers Are Not the Solution for Iowa Schools. School vouchers allow Iowa's per-pupil funds to follow students to private programs. Governor Kim Reynolds supports vouchers. Why should Iowans oppose school vouchers? First, the per-pupil funding is a combination of local property taxes and state aid. Public funds should be governed by locally elected officials, not private boards. Second, about 66% of Iowa schools are struggling with declining enrollment. Iowa needs to strengthen public schools, not divert funds. Number three, in 2017, Stanford Graduate School of Education professor Martin Carnoy analyzed 25 years of research on vouchers programs. Carnoy found that vouchers do not significantly improve test scores. Other U.S. studies support these findings. Fourth, private schools can refuse enrollment to students, putting at risk or special needs students subject to rejection or little, quote, choice. Number five, private schools are usually located in affluent urban areas. Rural Iowans may not have access to private schools within driving distance. Six, Iowa parents already have educational choice through open enrollment, virtual academies, charter schools, and homeschooling. Seventh, there is more to funding a school than the annual per-pupil tuition costs associated with facilities, transportation, lunch programs, and so forth. Vouchers could lead to more funding demands. And eighth, once Iowa enacts voucher legislation, it will be impossible to eliminate the program as parents and private schools become dependent on the funding. Ms. Baldwin ends, advocating for vouchers without conclusive evidence that will guarantee improved student achievement is a gambling game. I am not willing to gamble on the future of our students, says Kate Baldwin of Norwalk. I'd like to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 14th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. There are a number of them, just letting you know that. We will start with the shorter notices first, the death notices. From Atkins, Ricky Paul Stolfus, age 77, died this past Friday. Rayback Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plaine is assisting the family. From Kyoto, June Miller, age 94, died Friday, November 11th. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Kyoto is in charge of those arrangements. From Springville, Linda Nachazel, Nachazel, age 73, died Sunday, November 13th, just yesterday. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is assisting the family. From West Branch, Roberta Harding, age 93, died Friday, November 11th. Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service is in charge of those arrangements. And from West Liberty, Gail Ann Stensland Severson, age 79, died Saturday, November 12th, and the family is being assisted by Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty. The first published obituary is essentially a notice as well. Wayne Colin Gertz, age 82, passed away in Marion on Saturday, November 12th. Per family request, there will be no services at this time. And how there is, however, a public thank you. The family would like to thank the entire staff at Unity Point Hospice and Lynn Manor Care Center for all the love and care they showed Wayne while he was in their care. Larry W. German, age 88, of Grinnell, died on November 10th at Unity Point Grinnell Regional Medical Center. Visitation will be from 2 to 7 p.m. this coming Friday, November 18th, at the Smith Funeral Home in Grinnell, where the family will be present from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday evening. And then a celebration of life service is scheduled for Saturday, November 19th at 10:30 a.m. At Grinnell United Methodist Church, with a private family burial following that afternoon at Hazelwood Cemetery in Grinnell. Those who wish to do so may make memorial contributions to the Grinnell Fire Department or Grinnell High School TT Cranny Renovation Campaign. Next, from Vinton, Forrest Everett Chesmore passed away Thursday, November 10th at Virginia Gay Hospital in Vinton. His funeral will be held Saturday, November 19th at 2 p.m. at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point, and burial will be at Center Point Cemetery. Next, we have Dorothy Marie Metzger Edens of Iowa City and previously of Davenport, who died at 90 years of age on Friday, November 11th. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. They don't give any other details, but they do say memorials in her name may be made to Atrium Village, P.O. Box 220, Hills, Iowa 52235, and the family extends a public thank you to Atrium Village for what they say is exceptional care they provided to their mom. Next, R. William Field, of course known as Bill, Professor Emeritus at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, died Friday, November 4th, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics at the age of 68 from refractory mantle cell lymphoma. A celebration of life service for Bill will be held this Saturday, November 19th at 11 a.m. at New Life Community Church, 1703 2nd Street in Coralville. A private graveside service will be held at Oaklands Cemetery in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, you may make donations in Bill's memory to the Iowa Raptor Project Fund, the R. William Field Memorial Scholarship Fund, or New Life Community Church. And Gay and Chia is handling the arrangements. Continuing, we have Laverta May Siver Langenberg, age 88, who died Monday, November 7th at St. Luke's Hospital after complications from surgery. A joint celebration of life service will be held Sunday, November 20th at Bax's Sutliff Store and Tap beginning at 11 a.m. It is joint because they will also be celebrating the life of her husband, Louis Langenberg, who died August 1st. Next, Robert Dean Jeter, J-E-T-E-R, age 75, a lifelong resident of Iowa City, passed away Friday, November 11th at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. this Wednesday at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service, and then the funeral will be, or memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 17th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be made in Dean's memory to Camp Courageous, Easter Seals of Iowa, or Iowa City Catholic Worker House. Dennis A. Fitzpatrick, age 58, of Marion, passed away unexpectedly on Friday, November 11th, at his home in Marion. The family will greet friends and family from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 16th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Then a funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 17th at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Marion, where there will also be a visitation 1 hour prior. We have several more obituaries. Robert James Maroney, age 85, of Manchester, passed away November 12th at Oak Park Place Assisted Living in Dubuque. In lieu of flowers, donations may be directed to Hospice of Dubuque. There will be a visitation this Wednesday, November 16th, at Leonard Mullerell Funeral Home in Manchester, and then a funeral will be at 11 a.m., Thursday, November 17th at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, with a visitation 1 hour prior to that service. Interment will occur at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Masonville. We have two more to share with you. Francis Frank Paul Najedley, age 79, of Springville, passed away at his home on Friday, November 11th. In agreement with his wishes, cremation took place and no funeral service will be held. However, a public visitation will take place this coming Friday, November 18th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Those who wish to do so may make memorials in his honor to the Jones County Regional Medical Center in Anamosa. And our last obituary of the day is for James Allen Rotter, Sr., age 82, of Walford, who passed away on Saturday, November 12th at Mercy Hallmar. Visitation will be from 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, November 19th at St. John the 23rd Catholic Church, located at 8100 Roncalli Drive Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Then funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. that same day at that church with a private family burial in the St. Patrick's Catholic Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the Hospice of Mercy in his name. Well, we'll move on to the sports section now, and as best I can tell, as you know, regular listeners know that we focus on primarily prep sports, and I find exactly one story now. I'll see if I find any other scores that would be interesting perhaps for you. But here is a story by K.J. Pilcher. Mount Vernon Seniors Complete the Circle, Dateline Cedar Falls. Joey Romberg was in middle school the last time Mount Vernon played for a state football championship. He recalled how he started to aspire to be in their position someday. 7 years later, he helped make that a reality. Romberg said, "I was a little kid in the stands wanting that to be me someday. It's pretty awesome to get here." Romberg passed for a touchdown and rushed for another as second-ranked Mount Vernon topped number 6 Humboldt 14-6 in a Class 3A state football semifinal Saturday night at the Unidome. The Mustangs, with a record of 12-0, returned to the championship game for the first time since 2015. Senior Henry Ryan was at that last title game as well. He said his brother Paul was an underclassman on that team that included his role models like NFL players Tristan Wirfs and Jack Cochran and All-State quarterback Drew Adams. Ryan said, "I looked up to those guys. Jack Cochran, I love that man. I look up to him so much. It's great to be back. As a little kid, that's all I wanted to be, playing in the dome with my boys." Few had Mount Vernon on their radar at the start of the season, and it quickly made its presence known, stacking up wins to reach a 12-0 record after the semifinals. For all the doubters that existed, none of them were in the Mustangs' locker room. Mount Vernon coach Lance Peterson said, "All you really need is the guys in that room to really believe. You don't need anybody else to believe, and those guys did. Everybody on that bus ride here believed we could win tonight, and everybody on that bus believed we could win it all in August." Romberg finished with 148 yards passing and added 36 on the ground. Peterson said, "Joey does a great job for us. He's a great leader, a great football player. We're extremely proud of him and what he's able to accomplish up to this point." The Mustangs face top-ranked and defending state champion Harlan at 1 p.m. Friday. Harlan is making its 23rd state title game appearance and will look to add to its 13 state titles. Both are records. The Mustangs will be heavy underdogs again, a role they embrace. Ryan said, absolutely. Why not go for the best? To be the best, you've got to beat the best. I think we can do it. So I'm excited for that matchup. There are a few little, I guess we call them roundup stories, about some teams or schools that don't always get a lot of attention, their colleges, but let's talk about this. College field hockey is a sport that doesn't always get reported about very much, so let's cover this. From Evanston, Illinois, number 3 Northwestern won a shootout 4-3 to topple number 11 Iowa 2-1 on Sunday in the second round of the NCAA tournament at Lakeside Field. Iowa, with a record of 12-8, scored a fourth period goal by Leah Zellner, assisted by Anthony Zeal, but Northwestern, with a record of 19-4, countered 3 minutes later. That held up through two overtimes, forcing a shootout. Annika Herbine, Sophie Strybos, and Luke Sturbos made their shootout goals. Iowa coach Lisa Salucci said, I couldn't be prouder of this team and the grit and heart they displayed from start to finish. Iowa had beaten number 5 Virginia 2-1, and Northwestern had beaten number 25 Miami of Ohio on Friday, both winning by shootout. The Wildcats joined number 1 North Carolina, number 2 Maryland, and number 6 Penn State in the Final Four this weekend in Storrs, Connecticut. In college volleyball, Northern Iowa won the Missouri Valley Conference crown Saturday night, beating Missouri State 25-17, 25-20, 24-26, 25-18 at the McLeod Center. That was a tough one. UNI, with a record of 24-6, 17-0 in the conference, finished 12-0 at home. The Panthers had a season-high 82 digs with 11 blocks against the Bears. Sydney Peterson had a career-best 30 digs. Kyra Follert had 16 digs and 12 kills, and Taylor Alden had 56 assists and 10 kills. The Panthers close out the regular season at 6 p.m. this Wednesday against Drake in the Knapp Center. The MVC championships are November 22nd and 23rd in Evansville, Indiana. And on Monday, we have the community section of the Gazette, and there are quite a few entries here. So we'll start with Marissa Payne's article titled, Willis Dady Shares Holiday Giving Needs for Homeless. Willis Dady Homeless Services in Cedar Rapids has shared its annual holiday giving opportunities to invite families, individuals, and corporations to support those experiencing homelessness this winter. To give back this holiday season, Willis Dady offers challenges and gifting opportunities for people, families, congregations, companies, or clubs. First, there's a backpack challenge. Willis Dady started the backpack challenge during winter 2020. The organization is looking to receive and distribute 200 stuffed backpacks for its clients for the 2022 holiday season. Currently, there are more than 100 people sleeping outside in the community, according to Willis Dady reports, and a news release said, these critical supplies help them stay safe, healthy, and warm as the temperatures begin to drop. To participate in this challenge, people should find a sturdy backpack and stuff it with the following items that Willis Dady clients need. These are a folder to organize important documents, a small blanket that can fit in the bag, a toiletry kit including wet wipes, razors, and fingernail clippers and a comb or brush, non-perishable food and snacks, new pairs of socks, hand and foot warmers, a winter hat, a pair of warm winter gloves or mittens. Additional items may be donated and brought outside of the finished backpack. This will help Willis Dady ensure clients receive similar stuffed backpacks. Donations should be brought to the main shelter at 1247 4th Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids by December 19th, in time for clients to open the gifts and celebrate the winter holiday season. There also is an opportunity to provide gift-wrapped clothing. Willis Dady's emergency shelter has 25 beds for single men, 10 for veterans, 4 family units, and 10 for women experiencing homelessness. With the gift-wrapped clothing opportunity, clients staying at the shelter receive gifts of new clothing over the holidays, according to a news release, and then the clothes are given wrapped to the clients. The most common sizes they need are medium, large, extra large, and 2XL. To participate, people may purchase any of these items and bring them to the main shelter by December 19th. Packs of t-shirts, packs of socks, packs of underwear, sweatshirts, sweatpants, and long-sleeve shirts. For those who are able to wrap their gifts, Willis Dady asks that each item be wrapped individually and labeled on the outside with what the gift is and the size. If you're unable to wrap it, Willis Dady will ensure the gifts are wrapped before they're given to clients. Those items should still be dropped off at the main shelter by December 19th. There's also an opportunity to give shelter necessities, supplies that Willis Dady regularly uses at the shelter to provide support to clients and keep facilities clean for clients, staff, and visiting community members. Individuals may bring the following items to the main shelter throughout the holiday season to meet this need, and those are blankets, dish soap, laundry soap, or pods, trash bags, 13 and 55 gallon bags, toilet paper, disinfectant, and all-purpose cleaner. People may also impact by making financial donations. Willis Dady offers a secure online donation system at its website at willisdady.org/donate, or you can mail cash or check donations to the main shelter at 1247 4th Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The financial support provides services including shelter, homeless prevention, employment, street outreach, and housing to veterans and individuals experiencing or at risk of homelessness in Linn County. And if you or someone you know had been planning to go to the Roots and Boots show that had been scheduled for November 11th at Riverside Casino, that was the one featuring Aaron Tippin, Colin Ray, and Sammy Kershaw, that has been rescheduled to April 14th. 2023. I guess it was the cancellation or postponement was due to a minor medical procedure performed on Kershaw on November 4th that required that he be on vocal rest. Existing tickets may be used to gain admission to the rescheduled show. Ticket holders unable to attend the rescheduled performance can obtain a refund by visiting the gift shop and presenting the tickets with receipt of purchase, or mailing the tickets along with receipt of purchase to the Riverside Casino and Golf Resort for a refund. And then online purchasers who have not picked up their will call tickets may email their name and order confirmation number if they would like to pursue a refund. There's also a very brief notice about Hiawatha trees that are scheduled for removal. Hennick Tree Service will be removing 184 trees and grinding the stumps in the right-of-way and at Guthridge Park and Fay Clark Park this month and in December. The contractor will start in the North Center Point Road commercial area. All trees to be removed have been marked with a white X. Project completion date is December 30th. For questions, call the Hiawatha Public Works Department at 319-393-6601. That's 319-393-6601. And we'll close out by looking at some things to do today. I spoke earlier, but this is a reminder that Cherish the Ladies, an all-female group that performs Celtic music, will perform at 7:30 p.m. today at Paramount Theater, 123 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. That cost will range from $5 to $30. There's also an opportunity for a soup luncheon and sock drive. Enjoy homemade soups, breads, and desserts as part of National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week. That will take place 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. today at Gloria Day Lutheran Church, 123 East Market Street in Iowa City. The cost is a free will donation, and they'll also accept new sock donations for the winter emergency shelter. There is a kid-friendly event, Girls in STEM Take-Home Kit. The event is for take-home kits for girls in 4th to 8th grade. You can pick them up anytime today. In this activity, they're going to use pepper to mimic germs and show how washing our hands can make a big difference. There's no cost, and you can pick those kits up from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the Ely Public Library, 1595 Dowse Street. There's another craft kit. Add some Thanksgiving flair to your home with this fun turkey craft. The kit contains all the needed parts. Registration is not required. It is mainly for kids. Ask for a kit at our main desk, one per child, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can pick those up at the Hiawatha Public Library, 150 West Willman Street in Hiawatha, and there is no cost. And finally, if you or someone you know has been looking for a nice furry friend, there is the Pet of the Week, and they have a picture of a beautiful black female domestic short hair mix cat named Sheba, who is 6 years old. She has a lovely coat. Her ears look golden on the inside, and she has sort of emerald eyes and a beautiful face. She is available for adoption at the Cedar Valley Humane Society, 7411 Mount Vernon Road Southeast. She's described as being quite the character who also gets along with other cats. So maybe if you have a kitty cat and you'd like one to add to the mix and be a friend, you can consider Sheba, a 6-year-old small black female domestic short hair. And she's available through the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, November 14th. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.